I'm Stephanie Wilson, and you're listening to Freedom Over Fascism.
And so when you reach out and ask and invite these people who have like a, let's say like a 5 to 10% chance of registering themselves and showing up and voting, if you actually reach out to them, we're seeing closer to 20 to 30%, depending on the state, ending up getting registered, and they're voting at a rate of 80%.
Hi, all. Thanks for listening to Freedom Over Fascism. If you're a longtime listener, you know that I generally script my introductions. But I had a chance to be away and on vacation, and one of the things I decided to try to do was to speak more naturally and also try to avoid sounding like an idiot. I wrote about my vacation a little bit in the Substack, and the gist of it is that if you have a chance to get away from the news for a few days or a week and be close to nature, it can be really helpful in helping you rejuvenate and refresh and double down again on this election, because we know what the stakes are. Also, my thinking about the podcast itself sharpened. Not that anything's going to change, except maybe the introductions, but I have a different way of talking about it now. So we're going to continue to do interviews that help us all learn about the national context of this moment of constitutional crisis in our country. That's where we talk to authors and analysts and candidates and activist organizations. We're also going to keep talking about messaging, framing everything in terms of freedom, and making sure the voter is the hero of the story. We also will think about the information that we consume. We know the corporate media is not doing its job well and is not talking about the stakes of this election at the national level. So, two things. One is we're going to talk to people who are starting new media companies or who are independent journalists so they can tell us the reality of what's going on and also help us to know how to talk to and what to say to our community, because we're the best messengers. And lastly, we're going to talk to people who are in the trenches, activists who are working in different areas of the country, what they're doing, what's successful, what they could be doing better. And we're going to be talking to technology companies to hear about good tools and good data and better ways to reach our voters. So all this combined is meant to inspire you as an activist or a candidate or an official with new concepts, maybe a different strategy, possibly a tidbit that sparks an idea you might want to implement. And maybe it's about contacting the person that I talk to and learning more about what they're doing. I also intend for this podcast to remind all of us that good people are in this fight with us. And I'd love to try to create a community of activists and organizers and candidates and officials who are focused on the state and local levels. There are lots and lots of people out there focusing on national politics. I'm concerned about how we use that national surround and we do our jobs at our local level, at our regional level, at our state level. So today you're going to hear my interview with the CEO of Civitec, Jeremy Smith, who's going to talk about affordable tools for activists and organizers and candidates that provide better data about who's registered to vote, and more importantly, who's not, and good ways of contacting the people that we know either need to register or that are voters in our communities. First, though, I normally say don't pay attention to polls, especially not national polls, especially not the ones that are reported on by national corporate media. They're meaningless at this stage. People aren't paying attention. Some of these polls only have 100 to 150 people that they talk to. And everyone that I hear from says they don't answer their phone. They don't respond to polls at all. So we're not even sure who they're talking to. But there is one poll that Greg Sargent wrote about in the New Republic a couple weeks ago. And we do need to pay attention to this. It was conducted by Democrats, for Democrats, about Democrats in battleground states, What we learned is that only 30% know about what Trump has said he's going to do if he wins. We know that he wants to be a dictator from day one. We know he wants to round up people who look like migrants, put them in camps, and deport them as soon as possible. We know that he wants to ban abortion nationally. He wants to fire the civil service, thousands of people who make our government run on a nonpartisan basis, and replace them with people loyal only to him. And we know that we can read about this at project2025.org and on his campaign website about Agenda 47. But most people are not paying attention yet. They're living their lives. They're getting their kids to school. They're putting dinner on the table. We need to be the messengers about these plans with people who are Democratic voters or lean Democrat, because we can persuade them, but only if they know what the stakes of the election really are. So that's one of our biggest jobs until the election. We've also been talking about the State of the Union for the last week, so I'm going to say only a couple things about it. Biden rocked it. He tackled the age issue, right? Yeah, I'm old, but I have younger ideas. I have wisdom. And by the way, the other guy's old, and what he didn't say was not making any sense anyway. This address was one of the most consequential since FDR's nearly 100 years ago. President Biden foregrounded January 6th and the fact that the former guy and his allies planned and prepared to stop the peaceful transfer of power. He talked about the political power of women. Looking at that screen and seeing all those women in the chamber wearing their white suits, projecting their political power, and knowing that we women, activists, organizers, candidates, and men too, but that we have the power to change what happens in November in our communities, across our states, and in the national election. And one of the other big things that he did is he cast voters, us as the heroes of the story, as the protagonists. He used the freedom frame. He laid out a positive vision and talked about what his policies would do for everyday Americans, how they would affect people's lives. And that's what we need to be doing also. So how do we support this? We talk to people in our lives who don't pay attention like we do. We know that we're news junkies, but most people aren't. So, the most effective way to convince people to vote for our side or even to vote is that we talk to them, that they hear from trusted sources what the stakes of the election are, how voting or not voting matters, and what might happen if the other side wins and is happening as we speak in MAGA-captured states. So, thank you for supporting the podcast. Please leave a review wherever you listen. And now, here's my conversation with Jeremy Smith. Jeremy Smith, CEO of Civitec, welcome to Freedom Over Fascism. I'm really excited to talk to you today because you're the first in a series of people we're going to talk to about important tools for activists and candidates to be able to reach persuadable and already based Democratic voters in ways that we aren't doing right now. Can you introduce yourself and give us a little background about yourself and why you founded Civitec?
I'm Jeremy Smith, co-founder here at Civitec, and I got started in politics in 2016 on the presidential election, came straight out of the military to join kind of the transition team policy work with the Clinton campaign. Of course, most Americans don't care about foreign policy during a presidential election, so I promptly got sent to work on other things, which was great. Really loved what we were doing with voter protection, ending voter registration. And we innovated lots of really cool projects and systems that still play out today. But of course, we lost. And when I joined, I'd heard about the vaunted Democratic data machine, kind of articles that were written about Obama's wins over McCain and Romney. And I don't think that quite aligns with reality for most volunteers and most efforts within a campaign. And that's simply because the systems that we're relying on for set up in a previous era have not been maintained and improved, I think, in ways that make sense for kind of more modern approaches and efforts that are available. Specifically, we had issues where we wanted to run very large voter registration efforts, especially with young people and new citizens, but VAN, the system we all rely upon, is based around the voter file. And the voter file is something that the Secretaries of State hand to us of people who are already registered. So our list of people is necessarily limited to only the ones who already signed themselves up. And so we had no way to really run an organized approach. And so we had to use untargeted systems that were not sophisticated, like standing at the mall or outside of a Walmart, or using site-based techniques, which are at the time the best we could do. Ended up working on like a number of projects and a number of campaigns, testing out this idea in many different ways.
Yeah, that's always the thing. You come up with the idea and somebody turns it back and say, well, great idea. Run with it.
I definitely felt like I was not at all qualified to like run a business or start something in this realm. So I spent like 4 years nearly kind of interrogating the question of why isn't this already done? Like what are the reasons? And I kind of built like an expertise around, oh, this is a pretty fundamental flaw that is not easy to correct. This is not other people's business model. This is not easily implemented. And figuring out each of those components and kind of asking like, surely there's someone else who does this particular thing. And coming kind of to the position that like, no, there's really not. And so I was at a conference in like winter of the early part of 2019. And I met Alex from Ballot Ready. She's the CEO there. And she and I were talking at our first kind of meeting. And he told me about how many elections there are, which was kind of a revelation for me. I knew that there were, you know, lots more local elections. I had no conception of there are more than 100,000 positions up for election every year. And so that is where, like, for me, that was like the moment that clicked of like, okay, hang on, that is worth like working on and working towards, because we are basically losing a majority of elections by default, places where they are imminently winnable. And there are groups like, you know, Run for Something and especially Movement Labs' Contest Every Race initiative that just dramatically increased the number of people we have running in local races. And we are winning something like 35% of elections in Oklahoma in rural red areas because the elections happen at unusual times. A little bit of effort is really changing the dynamic. And so for me, that was like I actually think I could build a model around how big that opportunity is.
Well, that's something we talk a lot about is how much we give up if we're not contesting every race. And when you give voters a choice, they'll show up in at least numbers that will filter up. Even if the seat isn't winnable, if the goal is to get as many votes as you can, the votes will filter up to support the top of the ticket.
So this is commonly called like a reverse coattails effect.
And, right.
To me, it seems like a much better way to win statewide races than to try to have a few staff top down, like somehow convert everybody in the state into going that way. If you have people locally, you know, neighbors like, and they're like, well, that person's a Democrat and they're not so bad. And they're running for sheriff or they're running for judge. Or that is the way that you, I think, fight back, inoculate people against the kind of the partisanship we've seen kind of escalate all throughout the region, but especially in rural areas. Did not used to lose them by 90 to 10. And right. I think part of that is that it's not normal for there to be like the idea of Democrats out there. And so people are increasingly conforming into those kind of communities, or you have people who lose enthusiasm and they don't try because there's no one to represent them. And that's what we commonly see from all available public polling from Pew and others, is that the number one reason that people are voting is no one ever asked to. But if you talk to a lot of our leading kind of consultants and field efforts, they'll tell you, well, we only focus on the people who already vote because that's our best chance to win. And it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you're saying, well, they don't vote, so I'm not talking to them. And they're saying, well, you don't talk to me and I'm not voting. The person who, you know, wants to win sort of has to change that dynamic. We can't just wait for tens of millions of people to change their mind.
Right. And so when you go and ask them for their vote and show them that they have an alternative, and even if some small fraction of them turns out when they wouldn't necessarily have, that can make a huge difference.
Just a quick note on that is the average turnout here in Texas for local elections that don't occur in November is 4.2%. So we have won a ton of elections here by getting turnout up to 9%. And we've gotten like, you know, the first Black city councilor out just east of Austin in this area that's ruby red. And it's just because the election is held in like the second week of June. It makes no sense. But turnout, you can win a surprising number of races if a small portion of existing Democratic voters would just show up. But they don't even know that there is an election in the middle of June.
Right. I talked to rural organizers from Arizona a couple weeks ago, and they were telling me that their voter registration efforts and reaching out to people who weren't involved changed enough state legislative seats, because those margins are so small, that then flipped the Arizona legislature that last week was able by one vote to keep an anti-trans ballot measure off.
Exactly.
Those are very small numbers that make very big impacts.
Yep.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you build this kind of infrastructure that helps these folks? I didn't ask them in particular, but I think they're still doing it the old-fashioned way. They're inviting people, which is important, inviting people to talk, to get to know each other. But if they had a way that they could reach people more easily, people that they know, register more voters, keep track of who they've registered and how they're voting and what they're thinking, and use social media. Can you tell me how you think you have solved for a lot of that stuff?
Yeah, exactly. We break it into kind of two problems. Number one is like, first, how do you even identify how big is the problem? Where are the opportunities? Like the analysis of how can we even know where to focus our resources? And number two is on distribution, enabling the actual mechanics of helping people get registered, which differ by state and sometimes by county. In the cases of like Wisconsin and Michigan, they have, you know, over 1,500 local election offices. So it's just an enormous logistics headache. And of course, nobody should have to keep track of that. That's like not most people's thing they need to do in their life. So first, we focus on the data problem. How can we identify people who are not registered to vote, so we can begin to put metrics on it and see, are we doing better over time? Which I think is a fundamental requirement in interventions, is to make sure that you are consistently being honest with, is your effort working? And so we set out to find people who are not registered. And so my first attempt at this was a project called Map the Vote, which was an inversion of the voter file. So we took all addresses, all residential addresses in America, and matched them to everybody who's registered to vote. And then we took all those out, left the ones where the houses, the residential homes, of which there are not registered voters. And we gave that as a map that was free for anybody to use to help their neighbors. And this worked great in 2017. This was like early version on the 2016 campaign, 2017, 18, 19, tens of thousands of people using it, and then COVID. And since COVID, absolutely no success, no luck whatsoever with that sort of, you know, locally enabled door-to-door approach. But the concept was easy. It was like, hey, here's four houses in your neighborhood. Can you just figure it out? Like, why can't we trust you to do it? And if you have the inclination and the time else. And that was working very, very well. And a shout out to a particular group of women in Camden, New Jersey, who are elementary school teachers who we never met, but they registered more people locally than anyone else.
Oh my gosh.
No idea how they found out about it. Must have read it online or something, got up and running and just always, but like that sort of thing, there are people like that, little clusters of cities all across.
Right. And they're starting to come together in online communities. You know, Simon Rosenberg has pledged to go on every Zoom, right? And this is a huge army that we're not taking enough advantage of.
One of our advantages, it is an advantage of our whole side, is that we've always had more volunteers. We're used to leveraging it. I think we've struggled as like coming, like because of COVID and then coming out of COVID, we just haven't recovered our footing. But we moved from the address approach to actually, who are the people? We actually found this because of volunteers who are very smart in local areas. We have done tens of thousands of public record requests, identify names and addresses, matched into the voter file. We look for, oh, this is a currently enrolled university student, or this is a currently licensed nurse at this address working at this hospital. And we match them and we say, all right, there are 188,000 public school teachers in Texas who are not registered to vote. Let's work with somebody who's interested in that target set of community. And there's So we now have identified, we think, 71% of all current registered eligible voters in the country, just through like raw like grit of several women on our team who have done tens of thousands of these, you know, research efforts. And we literally get CD-ROMs mailed to us that we're processing and putting into an advanced infrastructure, getting rid of duplicates, matching to the voter file. And that's what powers our tool today and what we provide out to many different groups. And so now we're in the middle of launching version 2 of our tool, which will now be accessible to anybody online starting in April, where you can just come in, select your precinct or your district, and you'll have the voter file and you'll have all the unregistered voters on a map or on a list, works its integrated ban, all these different things. And that's really getting at the distribution challenge. Like, how do we take this data? One group of people has been able to collect them and actually put it into the hands of as many of those volunteers, campaign efforts, and professionals as we can. So people who know more about the area or are smarter than us, they can do things we never thought of. They can use ads, they can use texts, they can use door-to-door, site-based, whatever it is, but they can do it in an informed way. And what we can see then is, who is completing particular areas and where do resources otherwise need to be injected to make it.
So I think that's seems to be one of the keys, is not only giving them the tools to find the people, but giving them the tools to insert that data back into the system. So they're not just out there at a county fair signing people up on paper, and then that data just kind of disperses into the.
Yeah. And it's also because if you're signing people up at the county fair, so more than half of all of those forms that get turned into counties are exact duplicates of an existing record, meaning that if you collect 10 forms, 5 or more are going to be a duplicate in general. They're of this not going to actually add a voter, but maybe you reminded somewhere they weren't sure and they forgot and they're just, oh, you know what, fill it in. It's always good. And that's a great attitude when you're on the desk. That's the right approach to take. But then 1 out of 8 forms is illegible on the basis of handwriting, cannot be entered. And so, and then some of those people would have registered themselves, or they're just stuffing their name or their phone number or whatever. By the time you've done 10, really, you've gotten maybe 1, maybe 2. And it's just because, and now if you do a lot of that and you do it consistently, you can really make a difference. And that's the key, is that lots of people working together, breaking the problem down into small pieces does add up. So I want to encourage people that you should be doing those things. I also do that here in Austin, Texas. But if you are a campaign, a county party, a precinct chair, and your goal is to get more votes, there are more efficient ways to do that or target. And that is keeping track of each house in a given area, in a given neighborhood, on the street, in a precinct. And that's what we're enabling, is providing everyone that kind of system where they can log it themselves, has unlimited tagging capabilities. So you can, you know, mark all of your fellow members of the PTA or the other Girl Scout moms or whatever it might be that is useful to essentially organize around the communities that already exist.
And well, so one of the problems, obviously, in grassroots organizing is money.
Yes.
And there's a lot of people out there doing stuff for free, raising my hand here.
Yeah.
So how much would your tools cost, or how are you funding it, and yep, how do you make it sustainable?
Yeah, we think about this problem a lot, and like,
I'm sure you do.
We're trying, and like, it may not work, but we think of cost as the single largest barrier to access to it. So in our view, it needs to be as cheap or ideally free as possible. Right now for us, that's going to be about like $75. That's what we're targeting for something that counties, precincts can afford, candidates can afford. We need it to be so cheap that it's useful to them. But that means it can only work. We have thousands of people making use of it, because then to pay the cost of salaries for the engineers who build it and everything else to go very right. wide. But we know that that's the key, because if we make it expensive, then there's only, you know, 500 campaigns that can access it. And that's what's happened to most tools in our ecosystem. They've had to go that way just to be able to pay a handful of people to work on it. And it, as a result, we consistently see, I think, little progress and little success in our ecosystem. So we are currently starting there. We have ideas for taking it a step further and making it freemium and, you know, allowing people to like upgrade and buy data from TargetSmart or Catalyst or some of the other companies inside of it. The main challenge is just, we need a few barriers to of friction to avoid bad actors to like to avoid some campaign finance issues with particular localities who consider software to be like a corporate donation, then we're trying to solve each of those elements to make sure that you don't have to think of any of that. Simplest way is a small contract and $75. That tends to be
$75 once and forever or per month?
Probably end up being per month. But all of this is experimental, is to figure out that way people can turn it on or off if they need to, sort of thing. We may try to do like a store your data for $5 version. That way you can wait till the next cycle kind of comes back up. But we want it to be cheap so that like a county, for example, could pay $75 and add all their precinct chairs. No problem. That's the way we kind of proceed. We don't want individual volunteers having to pay.
Right. No, I totally get that. So let's go back to the data. I worked a bunch in Indiana and I've had conversations with people who say, well, everyone has access to VAN. And then we know that the people who actually win are using other data that is in addition to VAN, and plus people don't update the VAN files and it takes several cycles and blah, blah, blah. So can you tell me a little bit more about the data itself and how we can convince people that VAN isn't the sole solution?
Yeah, to be clear, like it's not the sole solution, but it's one of the best available current tools that's distributed. It's just that, to answer that first question, everyone has access. Less than 3% of Democratic campaigns in an even year use VAN.
So what are they using? Nothing?
Nothing. Most of them, nothing. Some of them might buy L2 or PDI. By and large, the majority of candidates on our side across the country are using VAN. And the reason is, again, it's a cost barrier or it's an access barrier. Because VAN cannot sell you you can't just go to their website and buy it. That's not the way it works. There's an agreement from 4 years ago with a different party that the parties have to be the ones to distribute it. Parties can't afford staffing or fund them anymore. So they put prices on VAN access, there tends to be, it's like between $3,000 and $25,000. Some states don't have tiered access or tiered pricing. So if you can't afford $20,000 as a school board candidate in rural areas with a $2,000 budget, you're just not on it. And so it's a practical problem. Also, there aren't enough staff at the state parties to be able to sign people up. So, for example, in 2020, the last cycle, we had Beto O'Rourke running for governor. We had some congressional races. We had some state house races. We had some state senate races. We had 9,200 local races. The total number of campaigns using VAN that year was less than 100 out of 9,200 available positions. And so,
wow.
Just as a starting point, this notion that everyone has access is unfounded. And it's an understandable misconception from people who are longtime volunteers who are heavily involved. I easily have access. And it's yes, but the state and county party system is a good one. It's just that we need way more volunteers, way more access, makes this much easier. And so our view is all of our tools integrate fully with VAN and state party's files because they need to. That means it's starting. But if you don't have VAN, we have a base file that is not the party's private file. And that's kind of the approach we take, is we think of it as more of a spectrum, and different campaigns have different amounts of money and they're going to be able to afford different things. So what we need as a starting point is something that is so cheap and so accessible that everyone uses it. Then we can have the power tools that a larger campaign might be able to afford and staff. But it's less than 3% on our best day.
These are huge numbers and very small numbers of people who are actually taking advantage of the tools that are available. So kudos to you to making it more available. So I'm helping out two local races in Massachusetts where I live. And yeah, no data that they're using. They're, counting on some social media and some lawn signs. And maybe a website, which, I've helped with. Is the focus of your product or suite the data itself, or do you have other tools that help people use the data?
Yes. It's a both and. It's got to be both, right? So our view is that we call it running mate. We want to be your first running mate and help you all the way up until you're hiring your vice president. That's the idea. And it's first, it is a dashboard for your campaign. So it will tell you honestly how you are doing. So for example, let's say your win number is 10,000 votes. There's usually kind of 8,000 people who normally vote Democrats, but you need to find 2,000 more. 2,000 can be a big number. It is intimidating as a starting point. And if you tell a volunteer, I need you to help me get 2,000 votes, they're going to be like, I don't know how to start. Right. So what we do is we take that 2,000, look at actual people who live there, and we say, okay, at 2,000, you need 40 in this precinct. You need 31 in this neighborhood. You need 100 over here in this precinct. And we essentially break it into bite-sized pieces. And then you can zoom in and say, all right, well, I need 30. There are 75 houses in this area where I have an opportunity. That's what the tool will show you. You need to go, you or someone there needs to go get 30 of those 75 in the next 4 to 6 months. Because the idea is if we break the problem down piece by piece, you can see it. And as you talk to people and confirm them and get a positive survey response, it'll fill in the progress bar for each locality and show you you're actually on track in these precincts and you're falling behind in these precincts. So you can focus your attention every day, every week, every hour, based on what is actually happening. So that is the core of the idea, is that we start out, we are measuring and telling you honestly how you are, and that will later have, not this year, but next year, that'll have the same thing for budgeting. So budget goals tied to actual voting and field work. The second set of thing we do is provide tools and services to actually get some of that action taken. So we have a fully turnkey capable SMS tool that we strongly encourage people to focus on as a community building tool and not as a cold spam tool. We have people just blasting messages and in a fire and forget way and never responding to voters and not listening to what they say. We think that's the wrong approach. So we encourage people to use it in a different way. So we have that tool called Text Out. And then we also have tools to help you actually register voters in your neighborhoods. So you can look at a precinct and say there's 20 people who need to be registered to vote who are new to that area who might lean Democrat. For $40, we will send mail to them for you, all the information they need, the letter, and we have a full call center where people can call and talk to us, text them. If they have any questions or any errors, if they have more people in their household, we take all of that on. We will get it, but it'll be your organization, your name, your message. It's tailored to every single region of the country. And so we have registered more than 2 million new voters with our tools over the past several years. We put barcodes on the envelopes, pieces of paper. And the reason we do it this way is because similar to everybody has access to the voter file, there's this thought that everybody can easily vote. And in some states, you might have online voter registration. I live in Texas where we don't. And, something like 15% of all adults live in a state where that's true. Something like 25% of Black Americans do not have a driver's license, and more don't have a driver's license in the state where they currently reside. And it's like 30% of young people don't have a driver's license. And there's actually an increasing number who don't have driver's licenses and people who have disabilities. And so this idea that we have automatic or online voter registration, these again are semantic problems of, we chose a word that sounds nice, but is not really true. It's online for some or automatic for some. And as a result, there's actually way more unregistered people than I think almost everyone realizes. And so mail is the way that is universal to everyone. On the federal form, you can use your social security number to fill it out. And so that gets you passed. And all the states are required to take the federal form. So even if they pass really awful laws like Arizona or Georgia have to try to make it much harder for people to register to vote. So for example, in Arizona, this bill was just struck down, I think, in court this week. But the state form added like a additional burdensome citizenship proof requirements. But the federal form, they have to accept that. And so we designed a method that essentially solves for everybody. And that is what we provide to many different campaigns and organizations.
So you're sending out a federal form that the states, no matter what their rules are, have to accept.
Yes.
That's smart. So you figured out how many people are unregistered, then you figure out how many of those that you have registered. How do candidates and causes figure out what the delta is between those people who they've registered and people who actually show up to vote?
Because the Secretaries of State will give you a list at the end of each election that says, Jeremy voted or not, Stephanie voted or not. Won't tell us who you voted for, but from that, we can tell who is actually voting. And so when you reach out and ask and invite these people who have a 5 to 10% chance of registering themselves and showing up and voting, if you actually reach out to them, we're seeing closer to 20 to 30%, depending on the state, ending up getting registered, and they're voting at a rate of 80%. So we're dramatically increasing just by inviting people one time from a stranger and giving them the tools and resources on how to do it, turnout is going way up. And it doesn't just go up in the year that we do it, it goes up 2 years later. So all of the tests that he did in 2018, 2019, 2020, they boosted turnout by 3% in all of those areas 2 years later. And we do this with scientific tests. And so we're doing this all the time, again, so we can tell people what actually works. We have tried many different ideas that do not work. And so we do not recommend those things, and we measure them accordingly. Yeah. Like, so for example, if you text every available household, that does not produce a net effect in kind of waste scrutiny. If you mail all the empty households in a given zip code, same thing, the waste of money compared to what actually happens. But if you send a targeted form to each individual that you know about, that, and then you follow up on it, you follow up with a text, the rate goes up. If you follow up with a text and a phone call, it goes up. If you follow up with a door-to-door visit afterward, the rate goes extremely high. And so there are like some of these rural candidates have been able to follow up and visit 2,000 households in a given election cycle. And they're registering like 70% of people who have never been registered before and never voted before. And they're voting at rates of like 80%. So it's imminently doable. We just have to break the problem down so everyone can do it in their area. We have to give them the means to keep track of their own work so they don't get discouraged. Because really one thing that we're trying to solve for is that the volunteer experience is quite terrible. And like, as much as we are all motivated and be like bond and make a camaraderie about it, we tend to run people ragged or to put them doing things that are not very pleasant and dragging them across town to go walk around a random neighborhood based on, you know, whatever was printed out that day, instead of helping them to choose like where can they actually make a difference consistently. And so we really want that volunteer experience to be a lot better and a lot happier and a lot more joyous and successful and community building. And we think that that's really what we're designing.
I find that to be really helpful because I say a lot, and I truly believe it, that hope is an action,
yes,
right? But that action has to, you have to feel like you are doing something and that you are feeling rewarded by it. And then you maybe will get some hope and aren't crying in a corner. And to be able to make that volunteer experience better, I think is really key. Are there specific states you focus on more, or is it a matter of marketing so people who know who you are, or all of the above?
So it's much more of a marketing challenge than it is anything else. A good example here is, and it kind of gets at the heart of this problem, is like not only do we have volunteer turnover, but actually in the last 2 years, I think it's around 80% or more of all the executive directors and the chairs of the Democratic parties have turned over. And 2 years before that, it's like 90% of them turned over. So in my case, I'm working with my like fifth DNC CTO, and I'm working with, you know, my like sixth executive director of, you know, a given state party. And there's a lot of time that has to be spent saying like, well, here's why we have this historic relationship and arrangement.
So the problem is that we need to reach the volunteers and the activists, educate them about what these tools can do, invest enough either in the tool itself or in infrastructure organizing so that it can carry itself forward, and then bring it to the localities and get people actually using it. Is that fair?
Well, that's what we're trying to enable is to bring down costs, increase access, so more people can participate, so that you give them a good experience so they come back and they build, like you build a stronger, more muscular, more well-trained and well-oiled machine. We want that to be the norm in every region, depending, no matter who the leader is. If you have a precinct chair who is wonderful, has been doing it a long time, but is not really able to like be there, like cultivating and growing the community, and it's really someone else who's like a local block captain or just a super volunteer, mm-hmm. that person shouldn't be cut out. And so that's what we think about, is like, we want to make it really easy for people to come to one place, get all the information they need, and then really are keen about this idea of measuring what you did against how many votes it generates. So we can show people there's lots of things you can do are proven to not get votes. And there's like a lot of research about, in general, the lack of effectiveness of like TV ads in most cases, or how people cannot be persuaded by a 30-second TV ad to change who they're for president. What we care to show people is that by investing in actual community, expand the electorate, hire more staff, really build our infrastructure, and think of people as the core part of the infrastructure. So that attitude is totally missing and absent, I think, in our ecosystem. We do not invest in people. We struggle to keep people in the movement, and we over-rely. We spend the majority of our money on ads that are wasteful instead of paying people. And if you compare to many of the Republican staff models, they pay a lot more to their people who are there for like kind of mid-career professionals. They stick around a lot longer. They are selling a much worse product, as you know, and other limitations, and they don't have as many volunteers as we do. So we, you know, I think we are competitive in other ways, but one area that we are truly failing is on supporting our staff, our candidates, our volunteers by not setting them up in advance and not building infrastructure. We are putting them out on a limb and making them do all this work for us when really like we need them. We need to be giving candidates a lot more from the beginning. We need to give precinct chairs and county chairs and super volunteers a much better experience, but there's no, you know, group that sees themselves accountable to that. The party itself, in many cases, has to be focused on winning the presidency. Like donors are pushing for that. Like, there's a practical, what can they spend their time and attention on to have the biggest impact? And I think there needs to be like a reassessment of party's job should be to support as many Democrats as possible, not just the most single important elections. But to do that, everybody needs to actually contribute more money. That's like fundamental to this ideal. If 10% of Biden voters would donate $10 a month, that would add $1.2 billion to the ecosystem. But nobody has ever succeeded at getting like 10% of our voters to donate in a given year. And I think that's weird.
Right. Or they donate to candidates because they fall in love with candidates.
And but that's definitely true. If you add up every individual donor to like every candidate, does not reach 10% of the presidential electorate of our voters.
That's insane. And also we don't have good grassroots ways to support the infrastructure through any sort of
donation to every county party. Right. We'd have to go online to 3,300 websites, find them, click the link, sign in, choose the donation amount, donate, like fill out all the info on our employer and everything else, like then find the next one. And it would just be miserable. To actually get, if you and I had enough money right now to donate to every county party, we would not enjoy it, even if we cut it as important.
Right.
Not easy. And like that should be a one button click, right? And that should be the thing that we are asking you on a regular basis. But all of that kind of infrastructure does not exist. We have not bought, because again, we are so reliant on the team outcome of politics, but the actual manner of getting elected is very much an individual sport.
If there was one thing that you want our listeners to know, and if you can tell them how to find you, that would be great.
Yeah. So the simplest answer first, you can go to civitech.io. That's our website, or you can Google Civitech, C-I-V-I-T-E-C-H. And we have a tool called Running Mate that we would love to help every precinct chair, every super volunteer, every campaign, every staffer, every committee member have access to. That is the goal, is we want you to be able to have full access to information. So in the past 4 years, 17 million people have turned 18. 13 million people have died, not counting COVID, just like normal death rates. So call it probably 14 and a half after you factor in excess COVID deaths. You have 4.5 million people have become new citizens. And the number of new citizens has been spiking. It has been like doubling in the recent years. You have 2.5 million people like going in and out of prison in that kind of time frame. And you have 30 million households that change states. And then you have a number like 190 million that have moved, you know, around their county, in their county. Some of them moved multiple times. 25% of the electorate in any district in America, in any state, is different than it was 4 years ago. And it's very hard to wrap your brain around that, because it's very intuitive to think, well, I'm in my 30s. I'm going to be voting for a long time. Like most people, it seems like it would be a little bit more static than it is. But it's just the law of large numbers. Like there are just lots of people who are dying and lots of people who are turning 18. And it's more than you think. And so we are missing an increasing number of people. And if you look at 2020 and you look at now, we have 25 million fewer registrations in the whole compared to where we were in 2020. And that works out to things like this. There are, you know, something like 69,000 fewer young Democratic voters in Georgia this time than there were last time in February of 2020. So we won that election by 10 or 11,000 votes. we are way behind. And that's just people like under 30 who lean Democrat. If you add it all up, it's more than 100,000 deficit compared to Republicans. And that is happening all across the country in nearly every state. And so the main thing I want people to take away is that like elections are very serious. It is worse than it seems right now. You ignore all the, you know, all the concerns about Biden's popularity, third party challenges, Gaza list, protests, leave all that off. The starting electorate for us is worse. But the opportunity, the number of people who are non-registered to vote, who lean towards us, has grown. We just haven't invested. We have killed many of our organizations. Many of our staff have turned over. We haven't money forward. Whatever the various reasons, we haven't made it easy. We haven't engaged with people. Disenchant. Our opportunity is bigger than ever. So action is what will solve that. And so what we need is for more people to volunteer, to donate, to run for office. Strongly encourage you to like participate in some small way that you can. Because right now, I think we are losing more than it seems. And it is hidden because of the way the voter file works. Like it is changing. We are winning in places like Kansas. We're making huge advances in Texas, Oklahoma. We're having tons of local wins. We have candidates winning in Idaho and Missouri and rural parts of Oregon. It is totally doable. So don't buy the idea that like elections are locked forever. It's about community intervention and more people focus, I think, is far more valuable than clever advertising. Like ultimately what we need to do is what has been shown to work across the board is like relational organizing. People talking to people they already know and bringing them along makes a very big difference, and almost nothing else comes close. So highly encourage you to get your head in the game and start now. Like this spring, right now, we don't put a dent in this. We are fighting a much more uphill battle come September.
Thank you for making that clear. And also, I would encourage our listeners who are not part of their county or local parties, but are, you know, have started nonprofits or advocacy organizations also to look at this and be part of the solution.
Yeah, absolutely. And it doesn't matter which organization you're part of. Like, I personally appreciate it. I think we're all excited and encouraged by how many people want to help make change there.
Well, thank you so much, Jeremy.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Freedom Over Fascism. Kudos to our editor, Benji Wilson. Please join our Patreon at patreon.com/freedomoverfascism. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts, and please drop us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts.